Welcome back. We are on Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, 37A3 in English. I remind you that Chanukah begins Saturday night after sundown, which is to say 5:15 p.m. this coming Motzei Shabbat, Saturday night, and as a result, next week's class will be our annual Chanukah class and party. And I notice, the point was made that some may have thought that the party preceded Chanukah by a week, but that's not the case. We don't do things like that. We always do it right on schedule. So the schedule is next week. Next Wednesday night. Okay?
That's God willing, and assuming that Laura will cancel her flights to Rio.
Laura, I didn't know anything about you going to Rio.
Dan is so prosaic to say I go to Rio. There's so many more other interesting places I have to go than Rio.
To abscond with.
Abscond with the $300.
Very good. Okay, now, we last time spent our session discussing this Mishnah, and we got down to the bottom of the page, and I'd like to just start with the last paragraph in the English section of the text. Remember that the Mishnah is discussing the value of every single human life, that every life is of significance. And the way it has taught that is to say that God created one person, and out of one person came an entire world of people. And so we have to remember every life is important. Then it goes on to say, Mivnei Shloma Briot. Another reason, another thing that we learn from the fact that the Torah begins with the creation of one single human being is to speak for the peace among people. Shelo yomar adam lechavero, abba gadol miavicha. So that no one can say to anybody else, my father was greater than yours. Ushelo yehu aminim omrim arbe rishiyot bashamayim. So the heretic should have no reason to say that there are many gods in the heaven, in heaven. This is the final one then, the final understanding that we have of the significance of beginning with one person. It is to speak the praises, the greatness of the Holy One, blessed be He. And the Mishnah describes, for when a human being mints many coins out of one mold, they all look alike. Umelech Malchei Amlachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He, tavak ol adam bechotamo shel adam rishon. Every human being was made minted on the matbea, the form of one person, and they're all different. Now, there's a concept here that I think we should just sit on for a moment. And that is the concept of the difference in the creation. The creation is a vast sameness of difference. That is to say, it's all different, but there are aspects of it that have similarities. Now, I don't know whether any of you have ever come into contact with a great book, one of the great books of the 20th century, written by a philosopher, really the founder of what's called the history of ideas, called A.L. Lovejoy. Professor Lovejoy wrote a book called The Great Chain of Being. The Great Chain of Being. If you want to challenge yourselves to read a fascinating study, the entire history of thought. You could do worse than read Lovejoy's The Great Chain of Being. And what Lovejoy writes about is what we call in philosophy the principle of plenitude. The principle of plenitude. That is that within the creation itself, all possibilities will eventually be realized. Okay? Namely, everything, nearly everything is possible, but not everything is possible. Among the Enlightenment philosophers, for example, you will hear that it is the best of all possibilities. That has become almost something that we know how to talk about. And we refer to many situations as the best of all possibilities. By that, we mean that not everything is possible. But that there are a large number of possibilities, and the principle of plenitude is that they will all happen in due time. They will all happen in due time. That is the nature, I would like to argue, of the creation described here. In modern cosmology, and this is a very, very big issue today, in philosophical discussions, in the discussions about education, is the extent to which the biblical story of creation is credible from a scientific perspective. And the argument is very frequently made that it's not credible, because if you are to be a believer in the Darwinian theory, then there is essentially chaos. That is the argument that's made. I don't agree with that argument. So I think that even Darwin never said that. In fact, there is in Darwinian thought an intelligent design. The whole notion of intelligent design, that is to say, that the creation has a certain rhythm to it. It has a consistency to it. And it has a measurable consistency to it, is, I would like to argue, the basis of all modern science. If there was no consistency to creation, there would be no possibility of science. Science measures the consistency in the creation. And it also knows what it can't measure, and it's always in search of a new rod by which it may measure things. But the very notion of creation in the Bible, which is articulated here, I think, at the end of the Mishnah, is that there is an intelligent design. There is a design to the creation, and it is essentially a mysterious design. That is very basic to the biblical idea. It's a mysterious design. Because as much as it is revealed, it's always not revealed. Not revealed. As much as we know what human beings are like, I had a teacher once, a great rabbi, who said to me, he said, one thing I want to tell you. He was then about 70. I'm almost his age. He said, you know, every year I say to myself, I've seen everything. And then it happens for the first time what I didn't see yet. It's an amazing thing. When you're young, you think you figured the whole thing out. And that you understand everything, and that you know psychology, therefore you can understand your parents, and you can understand your friends, and you can understand everything. And anybody who says you can't understand everything the way I happen to understand it is probably stupid, or is prejudiced, or they're unwilling to really think. Well, classical thought, as described by Lovejoy, Lovejoy really goes into Platonic thinking and follows it then through the whole history of philosophy, is that the principle of plenitude is such that there are a tremendous number of possibilities. And at no point in time do we really know what they are, even though we know what has happened, sort of. I'm fascinated always when I read archaeology. I love to read archaeology. And I read about some of the civilizations that the archaeologists understand. And I have this constant reaction to the archaeologists, which is, how do you know that? And it turns out that they know all these things because they've discovered, 67 objects. And from those 67 objects, they're expert in this, and they know how to build an entire civilization of thought. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of truth to it. So much truth that I keep reading it. I mean, it fascinates me. I think this is thrilling. And you get a lot of insight. But of course, it's all based on all kinds of projections from the things that we know to the things that we don't know. And it creates an entire reality. Any of you who have studied a lot of history know that history is terrific until you discover the next historian who tells you that what the last guy said was all wrong. And of course, before you've been in this, you say, how could that ever be? Because, either you're right or you're wrong. It doesn't work that way. Reality is that we come to understand things from our own experience. We do our best to project them back in the past because we know that there is a principle of plenitude. That is to say that there are a large number of possibilities, all of which will be realized, and there is probably a certain order to it, and we try to discover that order. We make sense of our existence and the existence of what happened before us. That is what I am arguing, finally, is the full meaning of this notion that God minted one person and every person then came different from that one person. Right? God creates a reasonable world, an intelligently designed world, where there are still an almost infinite number of possibilities. And in an infinite time, they will all happen, if they're possible. But not everything is possible. So it will only be the best of all possibilities is the only thing that will ever actually happen. Yes?
Does God ever say to us in the Torah that we can't know everything?
Does God ever... Not in the Torah. No, he doesn't say that in the Torah. That is left for the book of Job. Okay? That is left for the book of Job to say. So it's in the Bible, but it's not in the Torah. Okay? It's also in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah says it many times. Isaiah says, look up into the heavens and see who created these. Okay? That's Isaiah's language. Job has the same idea, but it's more in the context of suffering. He focuses particularly on suffering. But as far as the ability to know the limits on knowledge in general, that you find in Isaiah. Isaiah says, Lo machshavotai machshavotecha. My thoughts are not your thoughts. Right? That's Isaiah's language. And that is to say, the best of your thinking will always fall short. Okay? And that's always true. You go to a conference next year and they'll already be disproving what they proved last year. Right? But not that nothing can be proved. That's not what I'm trying to say here. But that knowledge is unfolding because knowing is unfolding. And it isn't as if being, to use philosophical language, is always the same, but it is always becoming. We are in a constant process of becoming and changing, all started by one, but always turning into something new. Right? That, I think, is the force of this creation of the single human being and all of the differential that comes after that initial creation. Yes?
So if we here recognize that the human being was created in one step with huge variance, spectrum of the huge variance, why our religion and other religion try to uniform us to be only one with specific concept of reality of life and mm-hmm. behavior, and why not to keep our variances, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. That's a good question. I don't have a final answer to that question because I think about it a lot. First of all, Judaism does as good a job of that, I think, as I would want it to do, and not a better job, which I wouldn't want it to do. I'll tell you what I mean. Judaism says, Sadikeu mota alam yesh lahem chelek la'olam haba. The righteous of all nations of the world have a place in the world to come. Okay. As opposed to religions that will say, you can't have a place in the world to come unless you're with me. Okay? So, on the one hand, that's a basis of a fairly good degree of tolerance. On the other hand, we have come to think that the only possibility of tolerance is where we fully accept relativistic thinking. That's the American, at least young American way of thinking today. That is to say, you can have a tolerant world if you know that everybody is right. It just depends on your point of view. Okay? That's a very dangerous point of view because the Nazis are equally right. Hamas is equally right. Terrorism is the same as what people do when they try to heal and help people and help poor people, all of us. It's all the same. Just matters where you come from. Okay? That is modern relativism. The way out of that is to say, no, there are certain universal ideas that are important for people to grasp and to share. There are certain universal ideas that are important for people to share, but not all. That's where I'd like to come out in this argument. I'd like to come out there. So let's say there should be a universal there shouldn't be a few universal beliefs. Okay? And the Bible definitely believes that there should be a few universal beliefs. Not a lot. We distill them down into seven, finally, by rabbinic thinking. There's seven Noahide laws. Okay, that there should be a belief in an ultimate being. Well, that's the hardest of them all, to tell you the truth. Others are a lot easier. Such as, for example, that there should be courts. Right? There should be a legal system. Now, there's no reason to assume that everybody would agree with that. But we really believe that all societies should function with a legal system that has a courts as its part, that there's a due process. We really believe that that's universal, that should be a part of every society. How could you say that every society, some people live in the East and some people in the South, some people in the North, some people in the West? Well, we believe that, that in China, it's also important to do that. You could have Chinese courts, you could do it maybe your own way, but we really think that they have to do it too. Because Mao decided that there was a universal idea, which was an economic idea, so he sent all the peasants sent all the intellectuals into the country to become peasant farmers. All right, and within a relatively short period of time, 35 million people died. Okay, this is a tzaddik. This is his kind of tzidkus. We don't believe that. That's wrong. That's wrong. And he's got to also be subject to the same standards. There's got to be a universal standard here. All right? Now, that universal standard has to do very much with what we have just said, the value of a single human life. These seven Noahide laws really, I think, have come, most of them, out of that. It's the value of life, the value of the single life. Now, surely not everybody agrees with that, but we really feel that. Anybody else? Okay, let's keep going. This we didn't say last week. It's a great idea here. After everything we have said, when we have underlined the fact of the significance of every creation, this is the last line of the page. right side of the page, I'm reading from the Hebrew. I mean, above the line, 37a3, therefore, every single person is obligated to say, Bishvili nivra olam, for my sake was the world created. What a fascinating idea. Yeah, you could think that's dangerous, you know, everybody would be self-centered and so on. But that is to say, because there was one human being at the beginning, we have to take every single human being so seriously that we have to say, everybody has to say, for my sake was the world created. Right? Everybody is that important. Every single person is important. Now, of course, we are saying this, remember, as the admonishment to the witnesses. The admonishment to the witnesses. So we are putting a heavy burden on them. We're saying to these witnesses, you have to realize, you might take away a man's life here. And therefore, you have to realize how important every single human life is. You don't like this person? No, that's not no reason to take away his life. Every single human life is so important. Okay. Now, as a result of that, now can you imagine being a witness in an environment like that and getting this kind of admonishment. What do you say to yourself? The Mishnah goes on. The Shema Yomru Malanu Velatzara Zov. Maybe the witness, after hearing all of this, will say, what do I need this for? What do I need this for, and what do I need this trouble? In other words, I need to be a witness like I need to be a homemade. You're right, I understand. Every human life is so important. I don't want to. You're putting too much on me. All right? Too much. You're giving me a guilt trip even before I get started. And so, that's what I need this for. Ba'alok far ne'amar. But remember that it's already said in the Torah. V'hu eid ora'a o'yada im lo yagi. If a person is a witness, or he saw something, or he knew about something, and he doesn't tell, okay? You're obligated. The Torah obligates you to be a witness. So even though, reasonably speaking, this is terrifying to find yourself in this position, you must be in this position because the Torah requires you to be in this position. If you have been a witness, you have to render correct testimony. Right? You are obligated to do that. You are not allowed to deny the fact that you were a witness. And you are not allowed to just not give testimony. Okay, then it goes on and it says, V'shema tomru ma lanu lachuv b'namau shelzeh. Maybe you'll say, now, after all you've said about the sacred nature of every single human being here, why do we have to even worry about taking a person's life? No, we shouldn't even do this. It's not good to take a person's life. You just keep telling me how valuable every human life is. You want to take it? Okay. And then it finishes the halok far ne'amar ba'avod l'shaim rina. The text itself is a little bit problematic, and I want you to read the Rashi to this. Text says, you got to remember that it was already said, namely, the scriptures say, this is from the, now it's interesting, it's from the book of Proverbs, it's not from the Torah, but the Proverbs say, Kavod Rishayim Rina, the destruction of the evil ones is joy. Now, that's joy. It's a little, doesn't fit our modern sensibility exactly. So I want you to see the Rashi here. You'll see the way Rashi read it in the 11th century. Just go across, this is the first narrow line of the Rashi. Remember, Rashi is on the inside margin of the Talmud text, and it's just the first narrow line. Balok var ne'amar ba'avod rasha'im rina. Don't you remember that it was said, the destruction of the righteous is joy. Im rashahu ein kan onish. Rashi sort of diffuses the whole thing and says, if the person was wicked, then he deserves the punishment that he's getting. Ein onish. You don't have to worry about being punished. So I don't think it says that at all. But that just shows you. Rashi had the same sensitivities, I think, that we have to some extent, that it's an insensitive statement to make. So he says it in a way that's, you know, far more palatable, I think, to the modern mind as it was to the medieval mind. He's writing in the 11th century. That simply the point of that is that you should, that the person who is giving testimony is afraid of being punished ultimately for doing what he's doing. And he has nothing to worry about. But that's the bottom line. Yes.
You keep talking about the importance of each individual life, mm-hmm. but then they keep saying, Ed, I mean, if two women saw a murder committed and willing to go under full investigation, their testimony would not be accepted?
No, it depends. Sometimes it is accepted. Sometimes it is accepted.
Saying Ed in the masculine.
Oh, wait, that's Hebrew.
Oh, that's neuter.
Yeah, and that's neuter. It would never say it otherwise.
Okay.
Yeah, Dan.
I'm surprised that we don't see anything about an oath here for the juror, for the witnesses.
It's very interesting. Yeah, the reason for that is that the Torah never says it. Torah has a very limited scope on oaths. Very limited situations where oaths are made. As a matter of fact, Torah generally doesn't like oaths. Generally doesn't like oaths. And I always wondered, with those Christians who won't take an oath on the Bible, you know, those who are religious Christians, what the reasoning is. I never knew what it was. Maybe some of you know. But I remember some president of the United States took the oath of office and said it in a different way in order not to take an oath. I affirm, right, affirm, as opposed to taking an oath. So the language of oath is problematic in the Bible, and it's problematic in classical Judaism. I'll give you the best example that you know very well. How do you begin Yom Kippur? Kol Nidre Ve'esare, and so on and so on, V'charamei Ushvu Atana, and Shavuot, and oaths that we've taken. We annul them immediately. We annul them. So the Bible basically doesn't like the notion of oaths. It'd be interesting to see what the history of that is in Western law. When does the notion of an oath and how does that come to be a basic piece of our legal system? Whether it's out of the biblical, out of the Bible, or whether it's another root entirely.
Oaths were very big in the Roman system.
So maybe that's what it is. Oaths were big. Mark says oaths were big in the Roman system.
Classical, I think it comes from Greek.
Uh-huh. That sounds great. That sounds very likely. Uh-huh. Because it's not from the Bible. Not from the Bible. As much as we tend to think, because you take an oath usually on the Bible. So put your head on the Bible.
I think that Nishba Elohim, as we say, that Nishba Elohim, came from Ba'el Elohim, and since at that time the Bible wasn't the Bible the way we have it now. Now we take an oath on the Bible because we came three times the guy came El Elohim. So I think the translation from that process to current judgment, maybe.
If you had to make it up, that would be a good way to make it up. I think the thing to do is we have to figure out the facts. I mean, there must be a history to this. Somebody probably wrote a book on the subject, but I never read it. I don't have the answer to it.
But even a contract, an oath, a promise that you will fulfill whatever is to happen. You think it's like an oath?
No, I don't think it's the same as an oath. It's different.
A commitment. Commitment.
Now, an oath is different. A contract is something which you agree to.
Yeah.
And interestingly, in a Jewish contract, for example, there have to be two independent witnesses who witness that contract. Okay? They are witnessing the contract. And then if they have to give testimony in a court, that's not called an oath. That's called simply testimony. That's testimony. They can say in a court, I was witness to the fact that this contract that said such and such and was written on such and such a date, that it actually happened. That's it.
But swearing in,
as I said, swearing in comes out of the American, or probably the English legal system, or Western legal system, I don't really know, but it doesn't come from the Bible. It does not come from the Bible, as far as I know. I mean, it may come from the Bible, but it doesn't come from the Jewish root in the Bible. It must have another, if it comes from the Bible, it comes another way.
Is anointing of priests and things like that a way of taking an oath?
No way. If it's an oath, it's called, you know what? An oath.
Oh.
An oath is an oath. You could say an oath is anything good. That's not true. There are 100 different ways to say something that is good or important or you're obligated. You're obligated for a million things. 613 commandments. It's not an oath. Okay?
So does an oath have a volitional part to it? I think we're all grappling with trying to make that distinction.
Well, we'll read the tractate Shibboleth. The entire tractate of the Talmud on this subject. I wouldn't get hung up on it. I think we should get hung up here. Yes?
That's what I was trying to say.
In a testimony volition. In a case, we already know that bearing false witness is a sin.
In the Jewish system. Correct. Yes, sir.
We have the Nazarites, and we also have a lot of rules about getting people out of oaths, especially women and children.
And adults. There's Ben, too. Strip everybody.
But I'm just saying, the Nazarites, which has a complex, is complex in itself, but they're clearly... There is an oath and a commitment beyond just a contract.
Again, I'm not sure. It probably is like an oath, but it's not an oath.
Not an oath. Okay.
Because every one of these is different. If they were not all different, then you wouldn't have Kol Nidrei, the Esarei, the Charamei, the Chinuyei, the Kinusei. Every one of them is legally a technical term in Judaism. And therefore, each one is dealt with differently. But they all have certain similarities. You're right. And the Nazarite, for example, I just remind you what the Bible says about the Nazarite, who has taken a vow. Right? A vow is not the same as an oath. That's kol nidre, the vow. The vow, he's taken a vow. That person has to bring a sin offering in the completion of the vow. So one of the things that some of the commentators say is, why should he bring a sin offering? Because you're not supposed to take a vow in the first place. Okay.
The swearing in, that has the same function of instilling fear in a witness.
That is correct. It is true that in our system, it probably plays the same role as what we have read until now, or at least something of that role, to instill fear in the witness. That's correct. I think that's quite true.
Although I do remember saying to an attorney of mine once, well, but he's going to be under oath. And he laughed. He said, what, do you think he's not going to lie because he's under oath?
There you go.
Do these courts have the ability to subpoena people? Because it sounds like if you have to be a witness, then the court could compel.
There is no subpoena power.
But it's like a mitzvah.
Correct. There's no subpoena power, but that's not to say there's no power. I mean, you can ruin a guy's life and make sure that he testifies. There are lots of ways to try and achieve that end, even if you don't have a formal subpoena power. Yes?
Well, it's the scary part of the oath. In the Bible, you put your hands on your thigh. That was the form of the oath. That was something generative there and something scary there.
Well, it is, as Rashi says, if I remember correctly, when Eliezer puts his hand on Abraham's thigh, there it's to be near the Brit Milah. Brit Milah. Okay? Because that is a covenant. And that is the way you take a vow, is to say, as this is a covenant between you and God, so oh, we have a covenant between each other, you and me. Okay? Yes, you're pointing me somewhere. Oh, yes, yeah, Elaine. Way back. Hello, Elaine.
Hi. My question is not about the oath, but about the obligation to bear witness.
Okay.
So, I guess in this trust is about courts, but let's say you're a witness to something that's going on. A neighbor is killing or is abusing a spouse or a child. Are you obligated to come forth with that information? And does this Mishnah or section have any bearing on that?
Probably not. It probably has no bearing on it. Are you obligated? That's a very complicated question, as you can well imagine. A very, very complicated question. But it comes from a different place in the Torah. The Torah says, Hochiach tocheach et amitecha. You shall rebuke your fellow. You shall rebuke your fellow. V'lo tisa alav chet, the Torah then says. But you must not bear guilt. You must not sin. You shall not bear sin as a result of it. There are two ways to understand that. One is, if you don't rebuke, you've sinned. The other one is, if you rebuke, you have to rebuke in a way that won't be sinful. Right? Which is, that's the touchy part.
So that's the very touchy. Is,
You just go around and tell everything that you know. You're going to get into trouble really fast. These things are not simple. They're very complicated. I was involved today in a complicated case. Just to show you the way things are so difficult. You know, in the last 2 years, we've had the appearance of this new category of abuse called bullying. You know, that all came through certain possibilities on the internet. Bullying. Okay, so the internet created some possibilities, and we all know the story of this poor guy from Rutgers who jumped off the George Washington Bridge, and then of the subsequent trial of the fellow who was responsible for putting it on the internet. So on the one hand, it's very good to figure out how are we going to control this. You know, people can be extraordinarily cruel, and cruel today in ways that they never could have been cruel before. So it's a good idea to control cruelty. And that had to deal with some people who are living with a problem. In the last 2 years, as a result of that, many school systems have created rules about bullying. Seems like a good idea.
Anti-bullying.
So it seems like not a bad idea. Frankly, all of you, I'm sure, every one of us could tell a story about when we were kids in school and the kind of really awful things that went on. Everybody knows. Everybody has such a story, I suspect. And the poor kids who had this or that who tended to be the object of bullying. It was sort of like growing up. I mean, these were sort of the wounds of growing up. We're at a different stage now, both in terms of the nature of those wounds because of the internet, as well as the society's conception that there have to be rules to deal with everything. There was a time when there weren't external rules, but there were sort of more internal rules, namely, families dealt with these things. I remember when I was a kid, one mother would call another mother and say, "Do you know what your kid did to my kid?" That was one way to deal with it. Another time, I remember it happened to me. I punched a kid in the nose. That was another way to deal with this. You punched somebody. Punching, and you didn't prosecute kids for punching because this was called life. This was life. Life. Sometimes you got punched, sometimes somebody else got punched, and it was the rough and tumble way that we grew up. I don't know that things have changed really very much, but I can tell you, as a result of this new case, this new effort to put controls on bullying, school systems throughout the state of New York are creating rules. So I'm made aware of one case today where a boy was accused of bullying. He's 13 years old. He and his family say, you know, he was horsing around. Probably not in the best way. If they sustain the accusation of bullying, he will be thrown out of school for 2 years. Thrown out of school for 2 years. 13 years old and thrown out of school for 2 years. Basically, the boy's life is going to, his life will never be the same again. So I said, well, is there a court of law? There's no court of law. All this is decided by local people who are appointed by the school board, appointed by the school board in the state of New York. That's why these things are complicated. Seems like a very good idea to figure out how to get rid of bullying. You know, how could you not be in favor of that? It's very hard to figure out the way to do it without creating a monster that's worse or as bad, or you know what I'm getting at here. So that's my long answer to your short question. Basically, it doesn't come from here. There are situations where, in fact, you are required to step up. But it's not simple to know which they are. But there are such situations. Okay? Okay, let's go on. Now we go to the Gemara. Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan, remember, is a Baraita. A Baraita was written during the period of the Tanaim, that is to say, those rabbis teaching up to the year 200. Rabbi Judah the Prince edits the Mishnah in the year 200. And so when it starts as a Tanu Rabbanan, we are going to read a Baraita. That the Gemara itself has many Baraitot in it, and here is one. Ketzad me'omen, how are witnesses told that they are not allowed to bring testimony based on conjecture? Now, you'll see, Omed, I didn't translate as conjecture, but as circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence. Partly on the basis, I translated it that way on the basis of what we're going to now read. Omer Lehem. Right? The judge says to them, Shema kach ra'ite. Maybe this is what you saw. Shiratz achar chavero luchurba. Viratztem acharav. Someone ran after his fellow into a room, and you ran after the pursuer, after that person. Umetzatem sayif biado, and you found a sword in the pursuer's hand. Vidamo metaftev, and blood dripping from it. Viharug mifarper, and the dead man is still twitching. In kach re'item, if that's what you saw, lo re'item klum, you didn't see anything. This is classic Gemara. Classic Gemara. Beautifully descriptive set of facts. Okay, if you saw this, you didn't see anything. Okay, no, you can't bring testimony based on this, because how do we know what happened between the time that you saw the first thing and the time that you saw the second thing? Maybe it was self-defense. Well, maybe this was a case of self-defense. You know what? You didn't. You saw it. You didn't see it. You didn't see it. You don't know what was going on. Okay, maybe there's somebody else. There was a third party. That party quickly escaped. They're hiding behind a rock somewhere. And you didn't see it. You didn't happen to see that. They got away later. Alright?
But he actually saw what he saw.
Correct. He saw what he saw. Correct. But he didn't see.
Correct.
So, but as far as bringing testimony in a capital case that can send this man to the guillotine, he's not going anywhere.
The trial where a guy is testifying, the man whose ear was bitten off, and the lawyer asked him, "Did you see the man bite his ear off?" And he said, "No." The lawyer then asked one question too many. He says, "How do you know he did it?" And he said, "Well, I saw him spit it out."
Very good. But you will say immediately, how can you have a system like this? Right? If you are so exacting that you must see everything in order to be able to prosecute this case, how are you ever going to be able to prosecute a case? Most of the cases are going to just get away from you. And then evil people are going to run all over the world. Okay? That's a reasonable reaction, I think, to what we just said. Keep it in mind. Next one. Tanya is also a bright Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach. Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach said, Areh b'nechama. Now here the note is a good note. Areh b'nechama means, may I never seek counsel. That's a way of swearing, in a way. Since we're not allowed to take an oath, and swearing itself is a problem, one of the ways that you'll sometimes see it, Areh b'nechama, may I never, and of course, it's the opposite of what he actually means. It means, what he really means is, may I never seek consolation. In other words, may my life be terrible if what I'm going to tell you now is not true. Okay? But in Hebrew, you can't say that. Instead, you say, Ereh b'nechama, may I see consolation. And you mean the opposite, may I not see. Im lo ra'iti echad sharata chacha be'ro l'chorba, if I did not see someone running after his fellow into a ruin, v'ratzti acharav, and I ran after him, v'ra'iti sayef biyadav, and I saw a sword in his hand, v'damo metaftef, and blood dripping off it, v'arug mefalter, and the body twitching on the floor, v'amarti lo, rasha mi haragol hazeh, and I said to this man, mi haragol hazeh, who killed this person? O ani, o ata? Was it me or was it you? Okay. That's a slightly different formulation of the same story. Was it me or was it you? Aval ma'ase. But he went on, he knows the law. He says, O bal ma'ase, she'en damcha ma'asur biyadi. But what can I do? Because your blood has not been placed in my hand. In other words, I can't really testify to do what I think should be done. All likelihood is that you deserve to get what you're going to get from this court. But my testimony is invalid because I didn't see it actually happen. Okay? Sha'arei amra Torah, because the Torah has already said, Al pi shnayim edim yumat amet. And here the commentary makes clear that it's not the tunis of the witness, but it's shnayim edim. You have to actually be witness to the act itself. Hayodea machshavot. Now here's what he adds. Hayodea machshavot yipara mioto isha haragat chavero. The one who knows thoughts, he will pay back that man. Now, that is a loose translation of what I said to you before was a statement from Isaiah. Machshavotai lo machshavotecha. My thoughts are not your thoughts. Who is the one who knows all thoughts? God. All right, so in other words, he's saying here, Yodeh machshavot, God, yipara me'oto ha'ish. He will punish that man, Shaharagat Chavera, who killed his fellow. Amru lo. So this is the wishful part of the story. Amru lo, they said to him, Amru, they said, lo zazu misham, they didn't move from there, Ad sheba nachash vehikisho bamet. Till a snake came and bit him and he died. In other words, he got what was coming to him. The guy got what he was going to. That's why I call this the wishful part of the story.
It happens occasionally, not often enough.
If
it happened all the time, it would be very good.
Correct. If it happened all the time, we could dispense with human justice.
Right.
Okay? Divine justice could take care of all of it. But it doesn't exactly work like that. Okay? Well, let's go on a little bit further, because I want you to see where the Gemara goes with this. You might think that what the Gemara would now say is what Herb just said, because it's totally reasonable, but that's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara goes at it from a different angle. V'hai bar nachashu, you just told me that this guy died as a result of a snake bite. Did he deserve to die through a snake bite? This is what they want to know. Va'amar Rav Yosef, didn't Rav Yosef say v'chein tani devei Chizkiya? And similarly, the school of Chizkiya taught miyom shechara bet hamikdash, from the day that the temple was destroyed, af al pi shebatla sanhedri, even though the Sanhedrin ceased to function in the temple, because there was no temple anymore. Okay? So the Sanhedrin was located on the Temple Mount, the Sanhedrin of 71, of 71. Arba mitot lo batlu, the four types of execution have not ceased. So though the main Sanhedrin did cease operation, the four types of execution have not ceased. Now the Gemara says, lo vatlu, v'ha vatlu. What do you mean they didn't cease? They did cease. Okay? So Gemara goes on. Ele din arba mitot lo vatlu. But the punishment of the four types of executions has not ceased. Mit shenit chayev skila. Remember, there are four types of executions in the Torah, as understood by the rabbis. Skila, Srefa, Herig, and Chenek. Okay? Skila is literally stoning. But in rabbinic law, stoning meant you pushed a person off a cliff. Okay? That's right. It's a terrible process. But that's the way stoning was done. Okay? Srefa, burning. Rabbinic law, you don't burn anybody at the stake. They don't have that concept. Rather, a person is forced to drink molten lead. It's a great way to go.
Which is worse.
Okay? Okay? Well, it's quicker. It's probably quicker. Molten lead. Okay? Herig is scythe. It's the guillotine. Okay? Cut off his head.
That's the fastest,
and therefore maybe, see, as we go on this list, we're going to have to wonder which is the most merciful, because in all of these forms, well, let's just get the last one, chenek is choking, so you take a cord, you wrap it around his neck, you pull that way, you strangle him. Okay? So, if you ask me, these are all bad. But the Talmud didn't ask me, and instead they're seen as a hierarchy, one worse than the other, and different kinds of killing results in different types of punishment. And so, those are the methods that we know from the Talmud, discussed later on in this Masechet in great detail. These were the methods that were used. Now, it's an interesting subject because it's got to be put in the context of Roman executions. Right? These are executions that have their roots in the Bible, but you know Roman executions. I mean, if we know anything, we know crucifixion. And interestingly enough, you don't have Roman forms here. So if we ever get to that discussion, if you really feel grisly and you want to talk about these things, that's an interesting chapter to read.
What's the relation of this to the Nachash idea?
Oh, that we're getting to now. So the Nachash is considered to be Srefa. 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 Why? Because according to the rabbis, the poison that came through the bite of the snake was burned him up from the inside. Okay? That was poison. The poison they equated with Srefa. Okay? So here you'll see it. Eladinar b'mitot lo batlu. Right, the possibility of the Bet Din, of the Bet Din of 23, now here we got to go back to 23, remember, was stopped. But the punishment themselves were not. The punishment themselves were not. What do you mean they were not? Misha nitchayez skila, a person who would have been subject to the punishment of stoning that I described to you before, nofel min agag, o chaya darasto. That person would either fall off the roof, or an animal would trample him. Okay? Mishu nitchayev srefa, a person who should have gotten the punishment of srefa, of burning, O nofel bidleka, falls into a fire. O nachash makisho, or is bitten by a snake. Okay, that's where the snake comes back. Okay. Misha nizchayev harigah, one who deserves the death penalty by beheading, such as a murderer. This is our case. Alright? Our case is the case of the murderer. The penalty for murder is Sayyid, beheading. Okay? O Nimsar Lemalchut. Interestingly, this is interesting. That person is either handed over to the non-Jewish authorities, to the Romans. Okay? Alright, the Romans killed him. O Listim Bayim Alav. Or robbers come and kill him. Okay? He's killed in a robbery. Mishinit Chayev Chenek, the one who deserves to be killed by strangulation, O Tovea Banahar, O Met Bisronchi, either drowns in a river or dies by choking. Dies by choking. Okay? So, what do we learn from all of this? This is really important information to know, I'm sure. The key thing is that this guy who murdered somebody and was unable to be prosecuted by it because there wasn't a witness to this, that this person then died to a snake bite. It doesn't make sense. According to the other brayta here, he should have died through Sayas. Okay? What was that? Either he should have been handed over to the Malchut or he should have been killed by robbers. Amre, that guy had another sin that he was being punished for before this. So this is one of those guys who was really bad. And when you have, and the rabbinic principle is, when there are two types of punishment that you're subject to, you get the worst one. So since Srefa is at a more grisly level than is Herik, beheading, so he gets the Srefa instead of the Herik. Okay? And it explains the Amamar, Mishinit Chayev Shtei Mitot Beidin, person who is liable to two forms of court-imposed executions, Nidon Bachamura, he receives the more severe of them. Okay? Now, this raises another point. You were thinking just a little while ago, this system of witnessing seems like a good idea on the one hand, because it comes directly out of the importance of every human being. Okay, we have a system that is so concerned about every person that an awful lot of cases are going to go unsolved and unpunished. Now, we read in the course of the development here another interesting fact, which we've mentioned before, but I think which is worthwhile keeping in mind here. And that is that when this was written, the courts didn't have that power. In fact, the courts had lost that power. The courts had lost that power. It says right here, El adin arba mitot lo batlo. Lo batlo? Aha batlo. Right? The power of the court to administer these forms of justice had passed. The court no longer had that power. So that's worthwhile to keep in mind here, that to some extent we're reading something, and also the reference to the Romans, the Malchut, of handing someone over to the Romans. It's important to conceive of what we are reading partly is a very well worked out system which doesn't really have to work very well, partly because it's not functioning. It's not a functioning system. Okay, you can have wonderful ideas and protect human life. As long as you don't have to really do it, it's fine. Now, a lot of people have terrific ideas, but I wouldn't want them to be judges. You know, they have. Some people should be social workers and not judges. Some people, it's just, you know, there are lots of good things to do in the world. For some things, you need backbone. You need to be able to send people to difficult places in order to have a functioning society. Now, what exactly that is, we're never sure. It comes up in this state on a regular basis every once in a while, whether there should be a death penalty, should not be a death penalty, whether life imprisonment is a good penalty, a bad penalty. These are not simple things, and I'm not sure that we'll ever sit back and know the answer to them. The whole system, the system of criminal justice, when you're dealing with capital cases, is a very, very difficult thing to administer, and to keep in balance the value of human life is something that you always need to try to do. We have to keep in mind, I'm saying that what we are reading is reflecting apparently a time when they didn't actually have to do it.
Mm-hmm. Do we know if this was ever put into practice?
No.
During the time of
My assumption is that the answer is yes. I can't find it very hard to believe that it wasn't put in practice, because it's in the Torah. Right? Particularly what we know from ancient society, these forms of punishment, or at least some of the forms of punishment, are in the Torah. Okay? I'm not sure that they're all there. The language that we have from the Torah, which is understood to refer to four different types of punishment, that's not clear in the Torah by any means. A term like skila is, though. Skila is. Sreifa appears a little bit in the Torah, but not as much as skila. Skila does. The stoning does. So we know that they had a system there. It's hard for me to imagine that they didn't use it. But that's not a great argument that I just made. Okay? Anybody else?
Yes.
Sorry.
Come
back.
Confession. What was the view of people who said, I did it?
Okay. Confession is inadmissible in Jewish law. A person's own confession is not admissible. Right? Simply not admissible in a court of law. That's why everything has to be witnessed by two independent witnesses. I think we made reference to this at the end of last class, where we were talking about the phenomenon which we see in our own society, where people confess to all kinds of crimes that they never committed. It's amazing. You put out too many facts in the media, and suddenly everybody is calling up confessing to the crime. What kind of sense this makes, God knows, but it happens every day. It happens every day that this is the reality of things. I doubt that that's why it was inadmissible in Jewish law. Professor Aaron Kirschenbaum, professor of law at Tel Aviv University, wrote a book called A Self-Incrimination in Jewish Law. A Self-Incrimination in Jewish Law, where he argues that Jewish law has a strong form of the Fifth Amendment. Okay? Not only that you can invoke it, but that it's impossible to actually testify. And so he tries to figure out why it is, and he comes to the conclusion that it's because of the Romans. That in Roman law, testimony was considered to be acceptable and the best form of evidence. And actually what the Romans did once they had that assumption was that they coerced testimony. They coerced testimony. And so he theorizes that the Talmud doesn't accept testimony, self-incrimination, as a way of defending and responding to the reality of what the Romans were doing.
Okay? Of interest, in a TV show that I watched, a woman confessed to the murder of someone her son had murdered. And no one had yet, thought of the son as the murderer, but she didn't want her son to go to jail. So you can imagine there were reasons why people would,
That's easier than some of them.
To protect another person. Correct. That some familial obligation, that sort of thing, could induce someone to testify with reason or passion. And that isn't not so rare. On this TV show, it seemed perfectly logical that she would protect someone.
There are such rational cases. I think there are a lot of irrational cases as well.
I'm really perplexed by this paradox, because it started off even when you talked last week about Heschel and how he was talking that's the wonder that Hashem actually out of one mold makes all of these multitude of people. And it continued then to say that we end up having all of this diversity here, and that's actually part of the beauty. That's something that we should respect and cherish. And you added on to that, my thoughts are not your thoughts. And we would add, we're not supposed to judge someone until we've been in their shoes. And you have all of this on one side. And then it's broken down in this way where we're ultimately supposed to judge these people, not just judge them, but even divide the punishments in this particular way, and it's putting this power in our hands. And it seems to me like, on the one hand, it's telling us to cherish life, and on the other hand, it's telling us to be judges. And that's why I feel like the resolution must be that in order to have order, you must take evil people out of society. But to go as far as to actually then execute them,
you need many snakes.
It just seems that would be putting power in our hands that was never meant to be put in our hands.
Mm-hmm.
It all comes down to the first word in chapter 4. The first word we read was achat.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, even the bad ones, we can't understand them, because my thoughts are not your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't go as far as to extinguish them. We might say we have to remove them for the sake of society, but we can't extinguish them. We can't put that power in our hands. Maybe I'm the social worker, but it just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, next time what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring to you the Mishnah in Makot. Well, I think we'll study that a little bit, where this is exactly the issue that's discussed.
Okay.
Because you're right. And there are two ways to go there. One way is exactly the way you're going, which is to say you can't have a death penalty. And it may very well be that what we are reading here is exactly that way. How do you get rid of it? You make it too difficult to actually prosecute anybody. That's a way to... You can't say the Torah doesn't tell you this. Instead, what do? You say, you can burn my molten lead. Right? And then the sensitive person says, that's terrible. And therefore, what are we going to do? We get rid of it. We can't deal with that. It's not for people to do it, to deal with something like that. So you're right. The other point of view is, if you were to do that, this world will be an uninhabitable place. Okay?
Why?
Because evil will flourish.
Not evil if you remove them and put them in a box.
You try to pay for it. We tried in New York State, for example, to take all the drug dealers and to move them into prison. We're still paying for that. You pay your taxes. It's incredibly expensive to do, and I'm sure in the meantime also plenty of people who don't deserve to be sent up the river are now up the river because of this idea. Not a simple thing. It may be a good idea, but it's got a downside to it. There's a downside, of course, to the death penalty. What happens? Maybe it's not so bad when a person deserves it. I'm not giving you that. You don't want that. But I'll give the point of view that's willing to take that. How often does it happen that somebody who doesn't deserve it? This has been the problem in this country. In this country, the issue really operated on two levels. One far more powerful than the other. The one that was more powerful than the other was that it seemed that most of the people who were going to the electric chair were black. Okay? Now, that was a very powerful indictment to the system. Okay? So that was very effective. The other side is that everybody is worthwhile and we should simply not have a death penalty. The Europeans, for example, think that the Americans are uncouth because we continue to have a death penalty and they've legislated it out. But the same Europeans, remember, who legislated it out, this is what's going on in Europe now, also have legislated out this week. In Poland, they legislated against kashrut. Right? They also legislated... Poland is this week prohibited the slaughtering of kosher animals. Okay? And
Switzerland too.
Switzerland for a long time has prohibited kosher slaughter. It's all for the sake of respect of higher values. Okay? It's very interesting. Take the subject of circumcision. Right? The Germans... Right today, the law in Germany is that it's prohibited. The Bundestag is dealing with this now. The Chancellor of Germany said, we're going to get rid of that judge's understanding. But let me just say a word about this subject. The idea that circumcision involves the creation of what could be conceived of as a deformity, as a damage to the body. I don't think that that's a wrong idea. I don't think it's a wrong idea at all. That argument goes back to the Talmud. It's in the Midrash. Midrash Tanchuma. Turnus Rufus says to Rabbi Akiva, Turnus Rufus, the Roman emperor, says to Rabbi Akiva, you have a primitive religion. Rabbi Akiva says, what's wrong with my religion? So he says, you believe that God created every human being. Right? Every human being was unique in the creation of God. And when a baby boy is eight days old, you immediately destroy that creation. That's Turnus Rufus. It's the Roman emperor. During the time of Rabbi Akiva. Right? It's the same argument that is being made in Europe today. It's not an unreasonable argument. Now, Rabbi Akiva has a reasonable argument against it. But it's not necessarily a compelling argument. His argument is, Rabbi Akiva then says, give me a bushel of wheat. And turnus lupus gives him a bushel of wheat. And he says, hold the wheat. And he says, now eat the wheat. Turnus lupus says, I can't eat the wheat. I have to get the kernel out of the wheat. And then the kernel has got to be turned into flour. And the flour has got to be baked by the baker. And the kiva says, I hope your ears have heard what your mouth has just said. That is to say that the creation is made by God. God created wheat and not bread. Remember that? When you say, Motzi lechem min haaretz, it's not true. Motzi lechem. God doesn't create bread from the earth. God creates wheat. And the process, when you say, Motzi lechem min haaretz, presupposes the human part in that process in order to create the creation that should be. That's Rabbi Akiva's argument to Turnus Rufus. Namely, there is a higher form of creation, which is through the will of God, through the will of God, and that will we know, and that is the will that we follow. Frankly, that argument that I just made, although I think it's a wonderful argument, wouldn't do too well in a court of law, I don't think, because it involves the will of God and the sense of a higher purpose. So I think that this subject of the importance of every human being and the sanctity of every human being is absolutely right. Absolutely right. Gotta watch out where we go with it, though, when we get down to the details. Okay? And we're sort of living with that today. We're really living with it today.
Well,
yes,
I think that the paradox is not so much in the rabbinics, okay, but in the Torah, okay. If God was the advocate of the primacy of the life and the nameless life. There are examples in the Bible where God takes the life, you know, for seemingly, okay, no reasons or minor reasons. The sons, the two sons, okay, of Aaron. It seems to me that it's capital punishment, you know, if we know it, is permitted in the Torah. So where do the rabbis take it among upon themselves, okay, to say, well, you know, maybe it shouldn't be.
You know why?
Why?
They were Jewish. They were Jewish. And that's my first answer. Second answer, you're making a proof based on the Bible. And I'm saying that Jewish rabbis, as opposed to non-Jewish rabbis, have a way of reacting. Once I was teaching a course in the summer school in the seminary. we had a guy in the class who was from Kansas, and he had been appointed the head of the Beth Sar Shalom Foundation or something like that. That's the foundation of Jewish Christians, the Messianic Christians, who believe in being Christian to make sure that all the Jews convert, and then Jesus and being Jewish, you can believe. So this guy was somebody to have in class, because the first thing that you have to know about him is that he knew the Bible by heart in English. Any of you who have ever dealt with any of these really Bible-toting Christians, they can know the Bible cold. They can know the Bible. So it wasn't a problem in my class. I was teaching modern Jewish philosophy. It's not bad. But there was a professor of Bible who taught before me. So one day, this was Professor Aaron Dembski, teaches in Israel. So this guy was in his class. So Aaron Dembski would teach the Bible. Of course, he taught it sort of through the eyes both of ancient history and from a Jewish perspective. So this guy would argue with him. He would argue with him. So one day, Professor Dembski had enough. And he just flew off the hook, And he said, all right. He says, you keep quoting the Bible. Shut up. We don't believe in the Bible. That's part. Where is it? That's part of the answer. It's that we're Jewish. No, we. It's like just constantly citing the Constitution and saying, "Don't you pay any attention to the courts of the United States of America?" I mean, the courts have, you know, we're a living system of law, and a living system of law, among other things, is living. It's not a dead system of law. It's not in a museum. It's a living system that continues to live in reality and to apply ideas in the context of real human life. And that's what you got in the Talmud. The Talmud is, in effect, doing that. So some of the sort of the ideas that are inherent, you know, in the Bible, give them 1,000 years or so and they begin to come out. They're percolate. But they're not simple because there's tension. There's always tension there. Okay? Let's go a little bit further. A little bit further. Got 5 more minutes here. Me'omet, okay? Remember the judge began when he was admonishing the witnesses by saying that you're not allowed to make your testimony me'omet, which they translated based on conjecture. Conjecture, I said, circumstantial evidence. Bedine nefeshotu de lo amdina. If this is true, when we threaten the witnesses, in effect, we scare the witnesses. This is in a capital case. Ha bedine mamonot amdina. This plot would imply then that in monetary law we do accept conjecture or we do accept circumstantial evidence in monetary law, okay? Which of course we don't. We don't, because in monetary law, in the laws of contracts, for example, laws of contracts have to be witnessed. If a person comes and says, you know, somebody told me that so-and-so loaned money to somebody else. Is that admissible in a court of law? It's not at all admissible, not in a Jewish court. Okay? The only thing that is admissible is the testimony of the witnesses to the contract. Right? Every contract has to be witnessed. There have to be 2 independent witnesses, and those witnesses can be called to testify in court. So, Gaman, Rabbi Acha, de Tanya. According to Rabbi Acha, who taught the following braita. Rabbi Acha omer, Gamal ha'ocher bein hagmalim. If a camel was seen mating among the camels, v'nimsa gamal arug betzido, and a camel was found killed at his side, bi'adua shezeh harago, it is certain that this camel killed it. In other words, they knew the behavior of camels. I couldn't. Don't ask me whether this is true. That when camels mate, they're temperamental. Another camel comes, bothers a mating camel, they'll kill him. Right? It's true for human beings, I know, but it's not. I don't know. It's true for camels. This is a camel. So this point of view in our Mishnah, which makes a reasonable inference, that is to say that it's true in capital law, but it's not true in the other kinds of law, in the monetary law, this follows the view of Rabbi Acha, okay? Where, in fact, the camel is dead there, and you put 2 and 2 together. You didn't see the thing happen. And it's a monetary issue because the question is, who's got to pay? That's ultimately the issue with the death of an animal. If somebody's responsible for that animal's death, it's your animal, you want somebody to pay up. Okay? So that is the case here. Okay? Any questions so far? Let me continue this. Keep away from a mating camel. That's selfish.